Hey listeners, turn up the volume. Not only do I want you to turn up the volume on your devices, I want you to turn up the volume of voices that have been silenced by power that propagates poverty. Turn Up the Volume is a new podcast and radio project coming out of the Social Development Center of Waterloo Region. This community needs a spectrum of affordable and accessible homes now for people with little to no income because they have a heartbeat and they are our neighbors. The show will be hosted by me, Angela, as I navigate a new-to-me city and learn how to advocate for a better tomorrow, not just for myself, but for those that need it the most. Listen today to Turn Up the Volume to hear stories and community-driven research from individuals with lived experience of poverty, homelessness, and precarious housing. Learn more about what's happening in your backyard and what we need to do about it.
Moved into your hood, you didn't think I should. Want to keep me hidden too close for your good. Pushed me out of there. The only thing you care is for your housing value. Not a second glare. I'm fighting for my right to rest my head tonight. The ends barely meet. I'm nearly on the street. I'm fighting for my right to rest my head tonight. The labels put on me are what you want to see. To you it may not seem that I have hopes and dreams. Sometimes life just happens, tears one from the seams. What is it you see when you look at me? Artist, worker, sibling, as you cross the street.
Welcome back to CKMS Radio 102.7. The song you just listened to is called For the Weary by local community artist Mary Neal in collaboration with an individual with lived experience of poverty and homelessness. We're going to hear more from Mary another week on this show. Today's episode is an introduction to the topic of housing affordability. I will showcase an interview conducted by Brian Doucette, who does research on urban change and social inclusion with the University of Waterloo. The interview's respondent, who wished to remain nameless, clearly describes why there is a need to talk about this now and how it affects someone at an individual and community level. He shares his personal experience and reflects on the changes he's seen in the Waterloo region over decades of his life. Most importantly to me and the work of the Social Development Center, this man presents what I will call a me story, a how explanation, and a what are we going to do about it. He shares his lived experience, an explanation of how things came to be, and finally suggests some sort of solution. Each future episode will follow this pattern and will end with a call to action. What we truly need is for each and every individual that cares and values human life at the fringes to act. If you don't have time to listen to the full episode, check out waterlooregion.org for more information about what we can do. I'm here today with Brian Doucette, and I'm going to be asking him some questions about an interview that he conducted for his research. How are you, Brian?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm good. Brian, can you introduce yourself and introduce us to your research?
Sure. So my name is Brian Doucette. I'm the Canada Research Chair in Urban Change and Social Inclusion in the School of Planning at the University of Waterloo. And I primarily look at gentrification and neighborhood change, and particularly the experiences of gentrification and displacement, as well as the wider political economy or the planning side of it as well. So there's two different aspects of, you know, how we get to it, why it happens, and then the other side being what are the consequences. And then through that, also thinking about solutions that that can mitigate some of its most negative effects.
Yeah, that's exactly what we want to be talking about here. Can I ask personally, what brings you to the table of the affordability crisis, and what personal values do you bring?
I guess a lot of my work is also, it's committed to creating more socially just cities. I see a lot of perspectives and stories and narratives about cities that don't necessarily align with what you see on the ground, or particularly when you start engaging with people from different communities. A lot of the work that I try and do is focused on deconstructing those narratives that don't tell the whole story, that seek to expose injustices in the city, working towards politicizing things like housing, things like mobility, things like neighborhood change, and then also working towards proposing solutions and forwarding and advancing ideas for a more socially just future.
Yeah. And specifically to the Waterloo region, why should we care about this? What should we be doing about it?
Well, here in Waterloo region, we're in a very interesting moment of transition. The way the impression that I get is that this region is shifting from a big, small community to a small, big community. Yes. And what strikes me here is that a lot of the contradictions that are inherent to planning our cities are very visible. In the sense that a lot of these things that we consider to be very good planning, the LRT, the intensification, the new creative activities, the placemaking that we're seeing, particularly in downtown Kitchener, we consider this in the sort of mainstream to be good planning. What comes with that is an area becomes more attractive, it becomes more desirable, and in our current framework, therefore becomes more expensive and exclusive. Mm-hmm. And that's the side of things that we don't always talk about as much. And a lot of the work that I'm doing here in Waterloo Region is trying to understand those inherent contradictions, trying to expose some of the stories and the experiences that maybe don't fit within that dominant narrative of good planning, and try to use that to, as I said earlier, to propose ideas and solutions that can be more socially just and more inclusive.
Next, we're going to jump into some of the research that Brian is doing. I'm going to be playing some clips collected from an hour-long interview. We're not going to listen to the whole thing. But for you listeners, as well as for Brian, listen carefully for what stands out about this individual's experience.
Money. Simply a matter. See, I don't know if you know this or not. On ODSP, well, it's even lower on OW, but ODSP, the shelter allowance is $479. You can't rent anything for $479.
Yeah.
And even when they talk, you know, even when they talk about, which I don't really believe it anyway, but the, you know, they talk about building affordable housing, it's still not going to be affordable for people like me. Mm-hmm. You know, like when they say affordable, I say affordable for whom?
Yeah.
Affordable for whom is right. For the sake of time, I'm going to quickly summarize what happened to him. He shared about the loss of his employment as a truck driver due to financial loss and significant health challenges in the 1990s. He sought support from Ontario Disability Support Program, or ODSP. He also mentions OW, or Ontario Works, the welfare system, in the segment he is about to describe.
This was 1997. I paid $280 a month for rent. On ODSP, I think then it was like $900 a month, and I was reasonably comfortable. I mean, I was still poor, but the shelter allowance then I don't remember what it was, but it was probably about $280 a month. Mm-hmm. Well, now it's $479, but the rents have tripled, mm-hmm. at least tripled, mm-hmm. but the shelter allowance has gone up by $150. Mm-hmm. And all these changes,
yeah.
but none of them are for me.
Next, Brian speaks with the respondent about seeing all the condos going up in Kitchener-Waterloo, many with starting prices at $400,000.
What goes through your mind? What do you think?
It makes me mad. You know, like, I mean, it, no. It just reinforces my feeling of being alienated. It's like they're rubbing it in, you know.
Welcome back to CKMS Radio 102.7. That was some good Canadian content music. We're going to continue listening to our clip of somebody with lived experience of homelessness and poverty, and then get back to talking to Brian about some of the reasons we've seen more and more people on the streets of Kitchener and Waterloo.
It's like being invited to a banquet and told you can watch everybody eat, but you can't. The last rooming house I was in was really bad. It was a crack house. And it was just nuts. And I'm kind of in a jam right now because I need to move.
Yeah. Is it tougher these days to find those kind of apartments that people on ODSP can afford? Like, has it gotten tougher?
Yeah. And what you get is, you know, it's barely, most places, like, they're barely livable.
If you haven't been paying attention to local news in the last while as affordable housing has been discussed, you may be surprised to hear this.
For subsidized housing, I've given up on that. Like, there's about a 7-year waiting list.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like, what's the point?
Yeah.
The astonishing fact that there is a 7-year waiting list for subsidized housing just begins to touch on the horrifying details of Waterloo Region's situation. This 7-year waiting list represents over 3,000 households, families, that are relying on the regional government's subsidized housing to support their needs. And even though this need is well documented, the region has only proposed the building of 638 homes over the next 10 years. At that rate, cutting down this waiting list will take almost 50 years to support those qualifying for subsidized housing, and that's only on the existing waiting list, not to mention any more people who may need these supports. The result is what you will hear from this respondent next.
I've noticed just in the last 2 years, like at the soup kitchen, the crowds there have almost doubled in the last 2 years. Yeah. So people are paid. They're using what should be their food budget to pay for rent because they, like, the shelter allowance on social assistance doesn't cover the rent.
Yeah.
So people's standard of living and their dignity is just going, every year it gets hammered down a little bit more. No one would eat there if they didn't have to. Mm-hmm. Well, improvements meant for whom?
Well, exactly. Yeah.
Like, I know it's not going to benefit me. Mm-hmm. Not in the least.
And that's our first clip of the episode, The Me Story. We're going to be listening to more from this individual later. Thank you, Brian, for letting us use that research. What crosses your mind as you listen to this segment played back?
I like the quote of sort of like being invited to the banquet but not being able to sit at the table. I think that was the wording. Because, of course, we see all these changes happening around us and often forget that there are many people to whom these changes are either irrelevant or they do represent the loss of their own homes or their own communities that are literally and figuratively demolished to make way for the new developments that are taking place.
And is that the type of experience that you typically hear in your interviews?
It's certainly something that cuts through the work I've done here and some of the work I've done previously on lived experience of gentrification, that there is this sense of, you know, it's nice, but it's not for us, particularly among lower income communities that are witnessing it taking place in their neighborhoods. So it's certainly a theme that recurs and did recur in a lot of the interviews that I did recently with the Social Development Center.
And that's our hope and goal for this project, the radio broadcasting that we're doing, is that some of these voices are amplified. We want to make sure that their voices are heard at least proportionally so that we can continue moving forward as a community, not leaving those individuals behind.
And absolutely. And if you think back to those three, what are essentially the three pillars of critical urban planning outlined by an urban planning scholar, Peter Marcuse, exposing injustices, politicizing planning issues or the everyday city and proposing alternatives, and certainly using these kinds of interviews and these kinds of conversations helps to expose these injustices. Oftentimes, a lot of people I don't think are aware of the living conditions, of the housing constraints, of the day-to-day challenges that exist among many people within our community. It also, by elevating these voices, it works to politicizing them. It works to bringing them to a place in the conversation about the future of cities that people from low-income backgrounds, people with lived experiences of poverty, don't always have.
Right.
And so if me as a planning professor can leverage some of those privileges that I have in order to help elevate those voices and bring them to a rightful position, not just as part of conversations, but actually as part of decision-making around how we plan our cities moving forward, that also works, I think, to the third aspect of critical urban planning, which is to propose alternatives. Mm-hmm. Because again, out of those lived experiences of poverty, you see that there are different interpretations of the city, different challenges that require different solutions.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Brian, do you think that the government is truly listening? How are we supposed to create change and propose alternatives when we're often faced with individuals who, like this respondent, may feel hopeless in the face of talking to the government and lack hope?
So what's happened is housing has shot up the political priority list. Mm-hmm. Now, this is an opportunity and it's also a challenge. It's an opportunity because for people on low incomes, housing has always been a major challenge, and we're talking about it now, so maybe we can get some solutions to it. But it's a challenge, or it's an issue, because we're talking about it now primarily because housing is also a middle class problem. So the people who are more politically active, who have greater voices at the table, are now themselves victims of a housing crisis. Right. And the challenge or the danger or the concern around this is that the solutions we come up with only work towards addressing those middle class or those middle income concerns of, say, young professionals who can't afford to live in the city, which may in fact conflict with the housing challenges of people on very low incomes, especially right. if we talk about what do we develop, right? We have scarce amounts of land, scarce amounts of resources. What do we develop? And yes, it's great we're talking about housing because it is one of the major urban challenges and has been for a very long time, but we just have to be concerned or just have to be careful about what we're talking about, what kind of housing challenges we're addressing, and do those address the full spectrum of issues around housing. Now, I think in some of the cities here, there is more emphasis on housing across the board. Mm-hmm. And I think there are some promising initiatives also with some of the discussions that some of the cities are doing, like the city of Kitchener. The proof will be in, I want to say the pudding, but the proof will be in the bricks and mortar.
Okay.
Right? Talk is very easy to do. Plans are very easy to do. If this leads to new, genuinely affordable, deeply affordable housing, mm-hmm. then I think we'll see some solutions.
Right. So, Brian, do you think that that's the direction we're headed? Or do you think that policymakers are more concerned with development on the higher end of the spectrum?
I'm not sure yet. I think there is a growing concern in city halls, not just here, but more broadly, that the housing system that we have now does not work for a growing segment of society. Mm-hmm. I think there's a growing understanding of that and a growing acceptance of that. What that means in terms of solutions, and are we able to think beyond the, let's say, the failures of the market to provide the housing that our societies need? I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. But I think we're at an important juncture where we're also starting to accept that the way in which we've developed housing for many years is not only failing people on very low incomes, but it's also failing a growing segment of the population as well. Okay. Right? You look around, I mean, just walking up here this afternoon past many, many construction cranes of building new condominiums, new towers, and you have to ask the question, does this make housing any cheaper? And I don't think it does. I don't know if we're there where we're really thinking of really of transformative solutions. The crux, I would argue, of our housing challenge that goes across the spectrum is that housing is seen in our society both as a home and a place of safety and security, and it's also seen as a source of wealth and investment.
That's right, yeah.
And I don't think the two can fully reconcile each other, right? So having a successful housing market in terms of a market that is making a lot of money doesn't fit the housing needs doesn't address all the housing needs of a community.
Right.
Right.
That poses a pretty significant challenge for people who are thinking about it.
And it's a challenge that gets to the heart of the issue. And I'm not sure that the solutions that are being proposed or have been proposed or put into practice are yet in a position where that fundamental contradiction is being addressed.
Right. Stay with us for some more conversation right after this. You're listening to CKMS 102.7.
The changing times can get you down. When you try to call her, will she be around? The land is flat. It's not like home. The stereo crackles when it gets four below.
This goes back to, I think, 1995 with Mike Harris. Mm-hmm. He rolled back OW by 22%, and he froze ODSP. Mm-hmm. Well, they stayed frozen for 11 years. And during that year, that time, we had about 3 or 4% inflation. And then the Liberals came in. They started giving increases of 1 and 2% a year, which were actually less than the rate of inflation. So all the Liberals did for the 13 years that they've been in power is they basically maintained the Harris freeze. If you want to get the highest return on your investment, you could build up a condominium or an apartment where you might rent it rented out for $2,000 a month. That would be a far better investment than building much cheaper apartments, because say you rented a place out for $700 a month, it wouldn't cost you twice as much to build a place that you could rent out for $2,000 a month. It might cost you a little bit more, but not double.
Yeah.
But your return is going to be double.
Yeah.
So that's what's driving gentrification. And what it means to me is using the market system to maximize your profit, regardless of the effect it has on people.
Welcome back to Turn Up the Volume on CKMS 102.7. What you just heard from our respondent is the beginning of our how segment. He described what, on a broader scale, brought about the social change. Continue to listen to the perspective he brings.
It's only about money. It's been happening a lot for a long time, but the pace has just rapidly increased in the last couple of years. I noticed this 8 or 10 years ago, but now it's like almost every couple of weeks I see more and more places being knocked down and more stuff going up.
Yeah.
Big part of it is that Toronto has become unaffordable for so many people. And there's a lot of people who are moving from Toronto to here because the prices are still outrageous. It's still way cheaper than Toronto. And, you know, they're talking about building the, well, it'll take a while, but, you know, this all-day back-and-forth GO service, which is a good thing, except that that's going to increase the, it's going to worsen the housing situation here.
Yeah.
Because it'll make it easier for people to do this.
Do you know people who are now moving further out?
I don't.
You said it wasn't of interest to you, but do you know of...
Well, most people can't because of transportation. Mm-hmm. That's the other thing, too, with this gentrification. There are some subsidized housing things available. Mm-hmm. Like, I've got a friend who, he lives in a subsidized apartment through Waterloo Regional. It's called Threshold, I think, now.
Okay.
They put him out in an apartment building way out by Bleams Road. It takes him 2 buses to get anywhere near downtown. There's no services out there.
Yeah.
The apartment building has got a huge parking lot because to live out there, you're expected to have a car. Mm-hmm. That's really the only way you get around. Well, I think what's happened, these agencies who run subsidized housing, it's not a written policy. What they do, it's kind of like self-censoring. What they do to keep the city happy, keep their grants coming, they purposely don't put people downtown where all the services are. Mm-hmm. So they put them way out in the boonies.
It's interesting you say that, because I have heard, speaking with policymakers and speaking with people in local governments, and again, it's not written in policy, right?
Oh, yeah.
But this
idea... You couldn't get away with that.
Yeah, this idea that the LRT opens up possibilities to build more subsidized housing further out where land is cheaper. So I've heard that from the other side. So it's interesting to hear your perspective on it from the sort of experience of it.
But they've just driven them out. There has been a, not just accidental, there's been a real deliberate and conscious campaign in Kitchener to kind of drive out these people who by their standards are, you know, are not as desirable to have around. They aren't going to build more subsidized housing.
No.
Even, you know, because it's still through the market. You know, why would you build subsidized housing when you can build high-end market housing?
So, Brian, in this segment, you comment on how he identifies a cause of the affordability crisis. And you identify that you've heard the same thing from policymakers, that low-income people are being driven from the city. Why is this happening?
It's a very good question. And what we've seen across cities around the world, say over the last number of decades, is increasing investment, increasing affluence that's sort of returning to urban cores, right? And this is often referred to as gentrification, right? The upward class transformation of a space that leads to displacement of its low-income population with the entire social character of the neighborhood changing. And it takes on many different forms. It can be taking an old Victorian house and that was a rooming house and kicking everyone out and renovating it and turning it into a single-family home. It can also take the form of large new investments such as condominium towers and so on. And so there are arguments to be made for why it's happening from several different perspectives. One being that people with more money, middle income, middle class people, want to live in the city again. Mm-hmm. A lot of the professional jobs, you know, I think of the tech sector here in Waterloo Region, that's increasingly based downtown. And so people want to be close to their jobs for a variety of reasons. They want to be close to the amenities of the city. So there's this one idea that it happens because of the demands. The housing demands of middle-income professional households. Another side to it is a more economic explanation that a lot of this housing in the inner city became run down, became devalued, became home to an increasingly poor population. However, the underlying value of the land in which these houses sat on remained quite high. So there developed a gap between what was actually earned in this property, renting, say, an old house out as a rooming house, and what it could earn if it was put to its maximum potential, which would be renovating it and turning it into a luxurious single-family home or a series of luxurious apartments. So that idea, the sort of rent gap, is a more economic side. There's another side to say, well, it has to do with policies, that this type of gentrified city with its nice consumption spaces, its middle-class neighborhoods, its nice amenities and so on. This is the type of city that planners and policymakers want to have. And so you read through policy documents in a variety of cities, and even if gentrification isn't used explicitly, the context of gentrification or the outcomes of gentrification are often very central to policy ambitions of cities around the world. And so it's those three elements that are creating this context where we're seeing rapid neighborhood change taking place in what were formerly working class or lower income neighborhoods or immigrant settlement areas. Increasingly now, not just in the downtown and the inner city, but that's often where it starts. And in a case like Kitchener, downtown is where for a long time, much of the lower income population has been concentrated.
Mm-hmm. And so would you say that there is a conscious driving out of people that he touches on? He says that he sees policy or that is being written or not written that purposely is driving people out. Whether or not that is done with a negative intention, we recognize that it is happening. Is it conscious, deliberate?
That's a good question. I don't know if I'm the best person to ask for that. I don't think, I think there's a lot of planners that also sit with these contradictions. They realize themselves that a lot of what they are tasked with doing, which is improving a city, making it more livable, enhancing the quality of life, invariably comes with an upgrading of an area, part of a gentrification trajectory that leads to it becoming increasingly unaffordable for many of the people who are already there. I think there's a lot of planners who are inherently aware of these contradictions. Now, what role planners can actually play in shaping those trajectories, I'm not sure. But it's certainly, I think it gets to one of the cruxes and one of the main challenges of modern planning, right? And we see it here. We see these two challenges in Waterloo Region, that when areas become nicer, when we invest in them, when there's new amenities that come up, that often leads to gentrification and displacement. And that's related to the second idea of one of the big challenges in contemporary cities is how do you build and maintain affordable housing near good transit? Mm-hmm. Because good transit is also one of these amenities that makes an area more attractive,
yes,
more desirable, and more expensive.
So why is it that we are seeing more homelessness or visible homelessness and hearing about the more precariously housed individuals?
Yeah, that's another good question. And I think it's very complex. And there will be, you know, specific circumstances to each case or each city or each context. If we try and sort of zoom out a little bit and take a broader view, we're in a situation where we just haven't built genuinely affordable housing for decades. Mm-hmm. Up until the 1990s, we had, and this sort of talks to the comments in the previous clip, you know, up until the 1990s, we had all three levels of government contributing to building housing. And we don't have that now. And even now with the national housing strategy that the federal government has, it's not about building more subsidized social housing. It's more about subsidizing someone's rent, which is often just a sort of funnel by which money goes from the government to a landlord through a low-income tenant. So we don't build the kind of affordable social housing that we did in the past. We didn't always build it correctly, or we didn't always build it in the best way. Regent Park is often sort of cited as the bad way to build public housing. So I would always counter that with looking at the St. Lawrence neighborhood in Toronto, which was one of the last major housing developments that was funded by upper tier levels, by higher levels of government.
And when was that?
That was started in the 1970s and finished sort of in the 1980s, I think early 1990s. And it was designed as a mixed income, mixed use neighborhood with a variety of different housing stocks and housing types. It kept a similar urban form to the rest of Toronto, which, unlike Regent Park or the neighborhoods that came after that, really tried to connect and integrate itself within the rest of the city. So if you go down to St. Lawrence today, it feels like the neighborhood's sort of always been there. It feels like it's part of the fabric of Toronto. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the housing in that neighborhood is subsidized housing. It's social housing. There's co-op housing. There's private market rental. There's also owner-occupied housing in as well. And so it's worked really well, and it stood the test of time. But we don't do that anymore. We don't have the funding to do that kind of housing. And so we get little pieces here and there, a few units here, a few units there. We talk about inclusionary zoning and negotiating with developers to get a few units, but we aren't able to we're able to build housing. We're building more housing than we have in ages and decades, but we're not necessarily building the right kind of housing to address the housing needs of people on low incomes and very low incomes. So what happens as a result? Waiting lists for subsidized housing increase, right? So it's 7-8 years, I think, in Waterloo Region for a subsidized housing unit. So what do you do in the meantime? And you struggle, and it ends up meaning that some people are homeless. So if we were able to build new housing that would cut down on those waiting lists, we might go some way to addressing some of the issues around homelessness.
Right. And what do you see as the role for social services in this situation? We're seeing that they're underfunded and overworked. Why? Why doesn't the average Canadian or why aren't politicians hearing those pleas for assistance?
That's a good question. I don't know if I have a clear answer, but I think for a lot of people, it's not really an issue.
Radar.
Yeah, it's not something they think about. It's not something that people are exposed to on a regular basis. If you live out in the suburbs somewhere and you drive out to your job in the suburbs and you go out to shopping centers and that, you might have very little reason to interact with that part of society or that part of your community or those places within your community where homeless issues and the consequences of homelessness are also much more evident and visible. Mm-hmm. So it's not something that is really on a lot of people's radars in the sense that it prompts them to do something about it. Now again, housing issues are skyrocketing up the political priority list. So it will be interesting to see what the outcome of that is. Yeah. And how we address those housing challenges that are now becoming politically relevant. Much more visible, right? Yes. Does this lead to solutions that end up dealing with these core issues of the housing challenge more broadly, right? That it's both a commodity and both a home. Do we end up dealing with issues that are directly related to homelessness, housing precarity, dealing with people, housing issues for those on very low incomes, which would lead to building new subsidized, non-market, you know, social housing? Or does this lead to more of a sort of middle class solutions, which might be, well, we need to build more housing. We just need to build more of it. We need to upzone our single family residential neighborhoods. We need to allow for more density to be built. Mm-hmm. And there's a certain value to that. And there's a lot of discussions about the sort of missing middle housing, right? We have a lot of single family housing, fairly low density, right? Two stories. We have these tall towers going up and we have very little in between. And so there's an argument to be made that if you allow for increased density, you will increase the supply of housing and hopefully, the idea goes, you will make it more affordable. I'm not convinced that this is an answer to affordable housing. It's maybe an answer to getting some more housing built, but you know, in the city of Kitchener, for example, you have as a right the opportunity to build a triplex on your mm-hmm. property. There's nothing in that saying that dictating anything about the price of those units, what kind of units you can and can't build. You know, you could build three luxurious units. Does that address that increases supply, changes things around the housing urban form, but does it address issues of affordability? Probably not.
Right.
So the types of questions that we ask and for whom will dictate the types of solutions that we get. And that's why it's very important to continue to raise these issues and mm-hmm. and also challenge the idea that, okay, just because we're dealing with affordable housing as a political issue, are we dealing with the full range of affordable housing issues in these political conversations? Or are we still ignoring many of the voices that you know, historically and all too often aren't heard?
Our last segment addresses the question, what do we need to do about it? Listen one more time as the respondent tackles this question.
It's not a matter of discussing it. It should be a matter of changing it. Mm-hmm. You know, like I could, you know, I could talk about this till I turn blue, but
yeah.
it's not gonna change anything.
Yeah. So what do you think would need to happen to change it?
What I think needs to happen, but I'm convinced that it won't happen. As a start, the social assistance rates, they need to be at least doubled.
The answer that makes the most sense is that social assistance rates need to increase with the rates of inflation. However, as described earlier, they have not. The political climate is not in a place where this reaches the agenda. When prompted again by Brian, the respondent has some more to say.
Yeah, so what would you like to see happen?
It ain't gonna happen, but basically, it would take almost a complete 180-degree switch in people's attitudes towards poverty. Poverty could be eliminated. We're one of the richest countries on Earth, and there is no economic need for people to live like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it could be changed. Just for an example, the Tories scrapped as soon as they got elected that guaranteed income project. They've tried that in other places where it has worked. Something like that. That would be a major thing if they had a guaranteed annual income for people at a livable level. They could do away with all this huge bureaucracy with social services. If people could live decently and didn't have to, like I spend my whole week out getting food. Like I go out in the morning, I'm not back till 5 p.m. because I've had to go to all these different places to get 6 cans of something here, 2 cans, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
If I wasn't doing that, if I didn't have to do that, I could be doing something useful with my time.
Yeah.
So what does the solution look like for this individual? He's moving to Cuba. As awesome as that plan sounds in this wintry wonderland, listen to the reason why.
Have you ever been to Cuba?
No.
Okay. Okay, the people are fantastic. The country's a mess. Everything's broken, cobbled up. The living standards by Canadian standards, they're really low. Mm-hmm. But I think you can see like why I feel more comfortable there. Mm-hmm. Because they aren't building wall-to-wall condos. People live in pretty rough housing, but there's no homeless people.
Yeah.
There's no food banks.
Yeah.
Like the living standards are low, but people aren't excluded.
Right.
Where here, living standards are phenomenally high, mm-hmm. but I'm excluded.
I can see
like
that.
I feel more at home there than I do here. I thought about it, and like, I don't really have anything to lose.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, moving to Cuba, I mean, that could blow up in my face too.
Yeah.
I don't think it will, but, you know, like anything's possible.
Yeah.
But I got nothing to lose.
Yeah.
You know, like, I can stay here as I am. Every year I get a bit older. Every year my health gets a little bit more shaky.
Yeah.
Every year life becomes more of a struggle. Like I've got nothing to look forward to here. Things are just going to get worse until I die. At least this I've got something to work towards.
Yeah.
That's what keeps me going too. Yeah.
Best of luck. I hope it goes well for you. But thank you very much for
taking that.
Is that the community that we want to create? Brian, what do you think would help prevent this kind of desperate solution?
Yeah, it's a good question. So as I talked about before, I think building more housing that's outside of the realm of market forces. So non-market, social, subsidized housing, building more of it, building housing to get people off the streets. I think that's a really important first step. And I think there are ways in which we can do that that don't necessarily rely on the private market to do it. Private market's very good at building market rate housing. It's very good at building housing for investment purposes, for speculation, for people with decent incomes. It's not very good at building housing for those in the greatest need. So we need to look to other partners, whether they be governments, whether they be nonprofit organizations, or a combination of the two, who can build housing that is deeply and genuinely affordable in perpetuity.
And possibly having support systems around them too, right? If we're just putting people in buildings, they may not be able to stay there long term. Brian, can you speak to the supportive structures that are necessary, or are you more focused on the actual buildings?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's others who are more... have more expertise in that than I do, but certainly, you know, having a range of challenges that manifest themselves in or are made worse by a lack of housing, building more housing makes them better, but you often need other forms of support, as we have many different organizations who do provide, you know, the modest amounts of housing that they are able to provide. Right, the House of Friendship and some of these other organizations as well, and the Working Center, that often comes with support for those who need it. Absolutely.
Have you seen strategies or things implemented in other cities or countries that have been successful in alleviating the housing affordability crisis?
Well, there's a couple of interesting ideas that I think are worth further discussing. And again, one's a sort of broad brush idea of, we have in this community and in Kitchener-Waterloo, Cambridge, we have a lot of publicly owned land. Mm-hmm. And we often sort of fail to recognize this, that when you go to a municipal parking lot downtown that's beside a tower going up and the LRT and so on, that land is owned by you and I and the people who live in those cities. And increasingly, also with changes in mobility, those are going to be seen as incredibly inefficient uses of those land just to have a surface parking lot. And so I think that's a really interesting point, a starting point, to think about building non-marketized forms of housing. So one option would be to sell that land to a private developer to build a market rate condo and maybe negotiate some aspects of subsidized housing within it or affordable housing. But that hasn't really been demonstrated to lead to the kind of solutions that are required. And then that land is gone. Mm-hmm. We're sort of selling off the family silver. And yes, you could get some money from that and do something else with it, but I rarely see that actually happening. So retaining that land and having conversations about what should be done with it in terms of building more affordable housing on that land, mm-hmm. you know, there are many costs that make housing expensive to build, one of which is land acquisition costs. And if we own and retain that land, then those costs are, they're zero for the acquisition costs and fairly modest to prepare the land in order for it to be developed. So I think that's one interesting aspect. I think there's, you know, I think there's small initiatives in our own community. The Working Center has been building affordable housing and supportive housing as much as they can. And there are some, there's a new development, a very small development near the train station that they're building. And that housing, because it's owned by the Working Center, that land is owned by them, that will remain affordable in perpetuity. So a lot of it has to do with ownership. The community land trust model, which has started, is gaining some more attention here, I think is another opportunity to think beyond the market in terms of solutions. So the Parkdale Community Land Trust, for example, in Toronto, they're still very small, but they've acquired a rooming house. And one of the big challenges in Parkdale was the gentrification of rooming houses, as I talked about earlier, right? Yeah. They're bought, everyone's kicked out, and they're turned into luxurious single family home. So the Parkdale Community Land Trust owns this rooming house, which also means that they can use that space to provide aspects for the community that the market is unwilling or unable to provide.
That's right. So if you were to speak to our listeners to turn up the volume on CKMS 102.7, what would you ask of them? What do people need to hear to help advocate for these kinds of solutions?
And I don't know if I'm in a position where I would ask people to do something. I would challenge people to look at their communities, to look at the ways in which those communities are portrayed more broadly and generally, and then to look and try and identify things that maybe don't fit within that picture.
Hmm. So challenging some of their own assumptions of what communities should be like and what Kitchener should be like?
Just what they see, and you know, challenge and encourage people to look critically for some of the inequities that exist within our city, within our communities, that are quite easy to brush aside, but just to look at them, and then it's less of me telling them what to do from that, and more sort of thinking, well, what kind of questions does this prompt you to think about? Mm-hmm. And what kind of solutions and what kind of experiences do these observations, do these sort of new ways of looking at your community prompt you to think about?
Right. Well, that's very helpful. Thanks, Brian. I think it can call for a lot more innovation in thinking about how to deal with this when it's coming from people's own perspectives. Thank you again, Brian, for coming and sharing. And I'm looking forward to hearing what listeners have to say.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Like our respondent said, poverty could be eliminated, but it starts with us. Don't wait until poverty, precarious housing, or homelessness affects you personally. Turn up the volume of the voices that are experiencing it now. Unsure how to do this? Let us at the Social Development Center help. What we need is this, a mindset shift. Practical and quantifiable things that actually help people in need, not just more talk and research. We need systemic change that informs development and legislation and vice versa. And we need more actual affordable places to live within the reach of necessary social services. So will you notice, develop compassion for someone struggling? Have a conversation with someone who is living on the margins, or smile as you pass by them on the street? Volunteer at your local social service agency or donate and learn more. Write your local officials to ask for sustainable, responsible urban development and to raise social assistance rates. Then hold these officials accountable and ensure what they are doing is actually helping those at the bottom of the spectrum. Invest in affordable housing solutions, nonprofits, co-ops, prefabricated and modular homes. You could even hire or rent to someone that has lived experience of poverty. And finally, share this episode with someone you know. Each week, we will discuss what we need to see to know that change is happening. Highlighted today is this, attitudes changing and the slowing down of gentrification in the region. No one should be left behind. Keep listening next week to learn more about things we can do now, or find more on waterlooregion.org. Thank you for tuning in to Turning Up the Volume, coming out of the Social Development Center of Waterloo Region. This has been Angela on CKMS 102.7.
Moved into your hood, you didn't think I should. Want to keep me hidden too close for